Welcome to episode 22 of the Infectious Myths radio show. One more show on world affairs, and then I promise we'll get back to science. But today it's going to be interesting to explore the lack of interest in civilian deaths in wars, as documented in the book The Death of Others by John Tierman, who joins me today. If you want to comment on any episode of this radio show, please email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, and visit us and join us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Use the hashtag TIM. We really appreciate likes on Facebook, follows on Twitter, or reviews on iTunes. We especially like it when you recommend this show to your friends. So I'm pleased today to have the author of the, I believe, 2011 book, The Deaths of Others, John Tierman, with me today. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
Your book tries to document how many civilians died in some of America's recent major wars and also tries to find out why Americans don't seem to care about what are enormous numbers and many of them directly killed by American soldiers. I'll just briefly introduce you and then we'll get started with the questions. John is Executive Director and Principal Research Scientist at the MIT Center for International Studies. According to Wikipedia, he's authored or co-authored 13 books on international affairs. Recent books are The Deaths of Others, which we're going to talk about today, 100 Ways America is Screwing Up the World, which was 2006, and Maze of Fear from 2004, and this year a book called U.S.-Iran Misperceptions. So, John, I'd like to start with the Korean War, and not because it's the oldest, and I don't want to necessarily go through this chronologically, but because it's probably the least well-known. And I know personally I've been to South Korea quite a few times, and it's very hard for me to picture a devastating war occurring in what is today a densely populated and modern country. And yet you see signs of the war frozen in time with North and South Korean soldiers glaring at each other across the DMZ. So what was the purpose of the Korean War, and why did it go so badly wrong, and why did so many people die? I guess it was a big question.
Right. Well, the last question is the easier one to answer, and that is that it is a very densely populated country, and it was in 1950 when the war began. Mm-hmm. It may be the most densely populated country, although I don't think that's literally true, but it's close. And so you have a very bloody war, a lot of bombing, huge numbers of troop movements around a relatively small peninsula, and you're going to get a lot of casualties. And also the way the war was fought. It was fought as a World War II style, highly mechanized war with you know, a lot of artillery, as I said, a lot of bombing. General Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Air Force at that time, mm-hmm. or one of the heads of the Air Force, talked about basically leveling North Korea, not letting a single building stand, which is something that they almost accomplished, if that's the right word. And you know, they bombed dams to flood large regions of North Korea and so on. So it was a very, very brutal war, much more so if you're sort of counting these things by a number of deaths per year. It was more violent than Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan, the other three wars that I discuss in the book. Now, the way that the Korean War came about is a fairly complicated story, but, of course, it was divided at the end of the Second World War, much like Germany was and other countries have been in history as a result of the war. So the Soviets had who had entered the war very late, the Pacific War, had control over the North. And the Allies, mainly the U.S., had control over the South. And the United States did not pay a great deal of attention to South Korea in those years. It was, you know, a growing dictatorship in South Korea, which we kind of let happen. And this then resulted in a kind of a anti-left military campaign in the South, which then provoked, in a way, provoked North Korea to invade. There was a lot of border skirmishing before, but then North Korea really launched a large invasion in June of 1950, and the main war then was on. But it's a very, it's a story of miscalculation and neglect and political foolishness, really. And when the North Koreans did finally make this major incursion in the South, President Truman, Harry Truman, did not want to, quote unquote, lose Korea the way that he was being accused of losing China. China had just gone to the communists a few months before.
Okay.
And so it became a place for the United States to take a stand in East Asia. And the result was about 3 or 4 million people who were killed.
Yes, and that's interesting. We need to talk about the numbers. So basically, it was the successor, the anti-communist successor war to China, which had failed, and it was pretty obvious that it wasn't going to be easy to get the China situation reversed.
We had been, the United States had been obsessed with China for many, many years.
Right.
It was looked at as being the new global frontier. You know, we had settled the entire continent. We, meaning European settlers, had gone through this, period of continental expansion. And then people like Theodore Roosevelt and others looked at China as being the next great frontier. So we'd really been focused on China for a long time. And indeed, people like General MacArthur, who, of course, was the victorious head of the Allied command in World War II, and then also was brought out of retirement, more or less, to run the, or from Japan to run the Korean War, wanted to attack China as well. So China was very much involved. It was a very prominent feature of the Korean War.
Right. Now, part of the reason for the high death toll in Korea was this bombing campaign. I mean, it seems like there's a belief in the U.S. Air Force, from what I can see, that if you could only bomb everything, that you could win a war without putting any boots on the ground. Just drop enough bombs,
right,
and you've won the war. But, I mean, that seems obviously absurd, because then you end up with a bunch of starving people living in the ruins of houses, and how does that restart like a non-communist democracy?
Mm-hmm.
I don't
well,
understand
exactly
the logic of that, but that seems to be what was used in the North, just bomb everything.
Yeah, well, there was a tremendous amount of what's called strategic bombing in the North and in the Korean War and to some extent during the Vietnam War. Even though a study of the strategic bombing in World War II had concluded that it wasn't really very effective.
And
when they talk about strategic bombing, of course, they're bombing, the ideas are bombing steel plants and munitions factories and things like that. But of course, precision was very elusive, and so a lot of civilians were being killed, and sometimes intentionally so. Firebombing.
And I mean, when
Japan.
when you bomb a dam, you might shut down a steel plant, but you also drown people, and you also cut off electricity for domestic purposes. Right.
Right.
I mean, even if you target the dam precisely, the effects of destroying a dam are not precise at all.
Yes. That's right. There wasn't much precision. But there was also, they called it strategic bombing and told the public that it was not intended for civilians so much. But in fact, during World War II, certainly, and in the Korean War, they conducted what they themselves called terror bombing campaigns. So, for example, in Japan, in addition to using atomic weapons, we used napalm bombs and set many cities on fire, including Tokyo, and, of course, the famous raid on Tokyo, which took 180,000 lives in one night. Just staggering numbers.
Right.
And in same thing in North Korea. Now, North Korea was not as developed as Japan was. So, you know, in sort of an ironic twist of all this, that kind of bombing isn't as effective because it's a more, you know, quote-unquote primitive society. But nevertheless, they use napalm there as well. And so, you know, you don't really use napalm as if you're bombing a steel factory, although I suppose you could. But it's really much more intended for wooden structures of housing.
Right.
And
right.
It was a very effective terror weapon throughout the latter part of the Second World War and during the Korean War.
What do you mean by effective? Like,
well, effective in the sense that it did induce terror. I mean, it was
right.
It was meant to shock the population. Now, of course, in one sense, it was not successful in even in military terms, because one of the objectives is to get the Japanese people, in particular, to turn against their government and.
Right.
And the war, essentially. And that didn't work, partly because the population, of course, was in a near state of starvation and so on. It was a survival kind of mode that they were in, not a political mode. So in that sense, it didn't work. But on the other hand, you know, it devastated society. So when the atomic bombs were dropped, the emperor was very quick to surrender, essentially.
Right, right. Another thing that you documented in your book about the Korean War was that there were several, maybe a lot, it's not that well documented, but deliberate massacres of civilians by U.S. troops. I think No Gun Ri was one of them. And these seem to be authorized by people up high. I mean, was this due to fear of the troops, of infiltrators? Like, what were the reasons why American soldiers
right.
killed defenseless? Apparently,
well, I wanted to write about individual atrocities, incidents, not because of their scale necessarily, because they were talking about a few hundred people, which of course is very sad, but it's not in the hundreds of thousands. But they're very indicative about the way the military and the civilian leadership in the United States thought about civilian casualties, on the one hand, and also about how the public reacted to the news that there was this atrocity. So in Korea, I write about No Gun Ri. Now, No Gun Ri was a place in South Korea, where some villagers had been rousted by U.S. military to evacuate the village of No Gun Ri, and then they were attacked by the U.S. military, supposedly because there was some fear of North Korean infiltrators, as you noted. Several dozens, hundreds, maybe, people died. They were civilians. You know, they were almost all civilians or all civilians. I don't think it was ever proven that there were infiltrators. And in any case, it was interesting to see that the command, the civilian and the military command at the time in Korea, this is in the summer of 1950, so the war had just begun, were approving these kinds of operations, understanding that there could be high civilian casualties. And these documents came to light much, much later through the reporting of a very enterprising AP Associated Press team.
Mm-hmm.
And the public, when it discovered this, which was not until the late 1990s, so long after the war was over, you had this mini debate that happened in which some veterans tried to discredit the AP reporters and you know, were defending the actions and so on. It's almost a replay of what happened with My Lai in Vietnam, which was a larger and a larger massacre and one in which the facts were not really much in dispute.
Right.
But it was the same thing, and that is that the military and civilian leadership were either approving of roughing up civilians. I mean, you hardly ever get them on record as approving the killing of civilians,
right.
Of course.
Right.
But, you know, an attitude in which mid-level officers took as being, well, we can do anything we want to do. And then a reaction to cover it up after it happened.
Right.
And then finally, when it came to light again in this case, because of an enterprising reporter, Seymour Hersh, the public at first felt horrified, but then to some extent rallied around Lieutenant Calley, who was the leader of the platoon that conducted the 400 death massacre. So it very interesting that the pattern is almost identical. And I also talked about Haditha in Iraq in the same way, although a much smaller number of people, about 24 people, I think, were killed.
Right.
But the same sort of thing. You know, it happened because the rules of engagement were loose.
Right.
Civilians were held in very low esteem, often viewed as the enemy.
Right.
A massacre occurred, not much doubt about that. The military tried to cover it up, and then when it became public, the public, to some extent, rallied to the perpetrator. So it's a very interesting pattern of these three, and I never found an atrocity in which the pattern was different from that.
Okay. I had often thought that the reason why Americans, and I don't think Americans are different than the citizens of any other empire. I'm sure Romans
right.
felt the same way. Were blocked from accurate information. That information was controlled, and so if there was a massacre by the Americans or whoever the empire was, it just wouldn't get reported back home. But what you're saying is, even when it came out, a lot of civilians didn't care or basically said there must be some reason for it. It couldn't be that our guys did something evil.
Exactly right. Now, you know, on the one hand, these atrocities did come to light, but we don't know how many did not.
Right.
So there is the possibility that there were several that did not, and I think Nick Terse, who is a journalist in Washington, wrote a book last year that I actually reviewed for the Washington Post about some documents he came across about Vietnam and some other atrocities, not at the scale of My Lai, but significant. And it just leads me to believe that there are many, many other things that are happening, perhaps on a smaller scale, that we never hear about. So there is that aspect of it. But what I actually find much more interesting is this reaction of the American public. And this was not something I was looking for when I started the book. I was trying to explain. Ultimately, I did feel that the public was indifferent to the to the scale of civilian suffering, both
right.
mortality and displacement. You know, just huge numbers of people displaced
right.
in these wars. 5 million in Vietnam. I'm not even sure how many in Korea. I don't remember the figures, but something comparable, and about the same in Iraq, actually.
Yes.
So what explained the indifference, which I strongly perceived during the Iraq War, and this was also true of these atrocities, a kind of indifference or resistance to accepting what were clearly, at least in the case of My Lai, were you know, indisputable facts of what happened. And one of the things that, you know, I came up with is using a social psychology theory called, you know, that basically talks about the expectation that people have about their society is one in which it's orderly and just and everybody does the right thing or tries to and so on. And when that is disrupted somehow, when facts disrupt that perception of reality, people tend to become indifferent or even hostile. So the example I use, which is used by the experimenters, is that you're walking down the street in a city where there is a beggar down the street and begging for money.
Right.
And, you know, how do you react? Well, most people just ignore him.
Right.
A lot of people feel agitated about the fact that this person is asking for money in a country where you feel like, well, if they applied themselves, they could get a job or whatever.
Right.
And the social psychologists explain this, and some people, you know, really, you know, blame the victim to blame the beggar for his state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the social psychologists explain this by saying that it is the presence of the beggar is a disruption of our view of society as a just society, and one in which everybody who plays by the rules and, you know, tries hard can succeed in some level.
Right.
And I applied this to these wars and the way the public views war. And the pattern was, again, fairly clear in all of these wars. That is that there was a great expectation at the time the war began that the United States was correct and just in going into this war and righting whatever wrong that they were, you know, being told was at stake. And then things go badly in the war. A lot of civilians are killed. A lot of maybe American soldiers are killed. It's costing a lot of money. It's not, you know, meeting the objectives of the war planners and so on. And so how do they react? Well, some react, you know, some people react with anger. Some people react with, you know, support still. But a vast number of people become basically indifferent to,
right,
especially to the suffering of the victims of the war.
I think we see that in Iraq today, where the country is falling apart, and it just doesn't seem to be a news item in America.
Right. I think what's going on, that's exactly right. What's going on there now, in terms of the American reaction to it, is very much a continuation of what American attitudes were from about, you know, from about 2004, when things started going badly in the war. You can almost trace this attitude and plot it on a graph through public opinion polls, although they never really asked the question the way I would ask it. But the, you know, Gallup and others have asked time and time and time again, you know, what is your view of the war? Favorable, unfavorable, things like that. And you can see just a spike of rally around the flag enthusiasm at the beginning, which may last a few months even, but then a very quick decline in that support.
Right.
And without necessarily condemnation of the U.S. government, but with this attitude of indifference, so, you know, it's a mess, is a typical kind of, what a mess this is, you know.
Doesn't
just want to wash their hands of it.
Right. I mean, it seems to me that at the start of a war, the goal is rather simplistic. Like in Iraq, it's like, let's get rid of Saddam Hussein, he's evil, and in Afghanistan, let's get rid of the Taliban. But when, in both cases, that was successfully accomplished, and yet then it just got a whole lot more complex. And after that, it was impossible for me to understand what the purpose was. And yet it was too late to stop the war. It had already started.
Right.
does that sort of match the disillusionment? Like, people are thinking, okay, well, we got rid of Saddam, and now the place is a mess, so what are we doing there?
Yes. Well, I think it is part of it, although it's never really been measured, as far as I know, in public opinion surveys. I think that one of the things that we don't do enough of is ask questions before we commit to a military intervention about what the objectives of military intervention are and what the sort of the red lines are of disengagement, or at what point do we disengage and why, and at least have that kind of debate. Because the fundamental fact is about all wars is that they're unpredictable, and once you get involved in a war, you don't know what's going to happen.
Well, I think
this is just
fundamental,
and yet the Rumsfelds and the others of this world talk as if they know they're in total control of the situation, mm-hmm. which is nonsense.
I think the plane that was shot down yesterday is an example of exactly that. Like, who would have thought that a Malaysian airplane would be shot down in a conflict between Ukraine and Russia? And yet that kind of thing happens, and who knows what the political ramifications are going to be of what probably was a horrible accident, but an accident that only happened because people were shooting at each other with powerful weapons.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it was an accident. It was an accident in the sense they didn't know it was a passenger plane, but somebody shot that thing down.
I mean, they intended to shoot a plane down. They thought it maybe was Ukrainian or Russian.
Right, right. No, that is a good example, and it could have tremendous consequences. It will have some consequences of one kind or another.
Yeah.
And that's just a mini example of what can happen on a much, much larger scale, and usually does happen on a much larger scale. That is, you simply can't control what happens during war. And part of it is our own sense of destiny and rightness, righteousness, and so on. We think that the Iraqis or the Afghans or, the Vietnamese are going to welcome us as liberators, as people who are helping and, getting rid of some bad guy or whatever. When, in fact, the cultural understandings are so thin on our part, we simply don't understand these societies, and that the people who are there and living these lives don't necessarily have the same kinds of perceptions and priorities that we do. And we've never learned that lesson, at least not yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, were the Iraqis happy that Saddam was eliminated?
Well, it's an interesting question because it's almost certainly true that the Shia, which is 60% of Iraq, were happy to see Saddam overthrown.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that most Iraqis, as far as I could tell from surveys, and there were a number of surveys taken in Iraq during the war, had kind of mixed feelings about the American presence. On the one hand, they were, unless you're a Sunni Arab, you're pleased to get rid of Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they were really not happy that the United States was occupying the country, and that they blamed almost all the violence on U.S. troops, even though it was clear at a certain point that a lot of the violence was Iraqi on Iraqi violence, but the opinion throughout society was that this had been caused by the invasion, which of course is essentially true.
Well, I guess Saddam Hussein, I don't think there's too many fans of him, but his brutality did kind of keep other violent tendencies in society under control, as well as obviously keeping any kind of dissent under control as well. It seems like it wasn't necessarily just direct U.S. violence, but just the sort of the permission the lack of authority and the permission that anybody with a gun had to go out and do whatever they wanted with it.
That's right. That's right. Now, there was a tremendous amount of killing and revenge killing and that sort of thing. We did, you know, I commissioned one of the mortality studies that were done by Johns Hopkins researchers in Iraq. And one of the interesting findings of this was not only the scale of killing was much larger than people had imagined at that point, but that the way people were being killed was mainly by gunshot and not through car bombs and suicide bombs or from bombing from the air, those kind of things that, you know, was sort of assumed to be the major sources of mortality. It was a lot of gunshots, and what that meant, in part at least, was that there was a lot of revenge killing going on.
Right.
And
right.
This we're talking about 2006, 2005, 2006. Well, and it was basically a lawless society in many ways. It was the U.S. presence was strong in a very small number of places, basically. And at a certain point, it became so dangerous that even the U.S. troops were not deployed as you know aggressively as one might imagine. And we had, you know, we had an obligation under the Geneva Conventions to restore order. The occupying power has that responsibility.
Right.
And we didn't do it.
No, in fact, the decision of Brannon to ban members of the Baath Party from any role in government basically eliminated the structure of the bureaucracy.
Right. There were a lot of issues like that that basically stripped Iraq of people who knew how to keep order and people who had some military training and so on. You know, Iraq was much like the Soviet Union in the sense that, you know, in order to succeed in society, you had to belong to the party, whatever the party was, the Communist Party, in this case, the Baath Party. So there were a lot of Baathists who were not, like, committed Saddam Hussein followers. They just wanted to live their lives and felt they had to join the Baath Party. So it was a very, very foolish decision. And, again, it was a reflection of our thin cultural understanding of Iraq, in this case, the political culture. You put Paul Bremer in there, who knows nothing about Iraq, nothing when he got there. And he was the major domo. I mean, he was the guy who was running things.
Yeah.
And he made a lot of mistakes.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about how you count civilian deaths. I mean, I think everybody rationally would say that, you know, if there's a war, we should know what the consequences are, and yet there doesn't seem to be a systematic counting of civilian deaths by the American administration in Iraq. So there's some interesting methods that people like yourself have used to try to count deaths. And can you describe some of those, like the Lancet study, or
right? Well, there are several possible ways of calculating mortality, the number of people who died in the war. And the one that we were using, I think, is generally accepted by the scientific community as being the most reliable, although there are difficulties in applying it during wartime. Mm-hmm. And that is, you take a randomized survey, that is, a survey like a poll, an opinion poll, although you're not asking them their opinion, you're asking them facts about their household and if anybody had died who was living in their household and when that person died and how they died and do you have a death certificate and that sort of thing. And it's randomized in the sense that you choose households randomly in order to get a cross-section of the population. And then there are statistical methods to analyze that data, and you come up with a number, a range, typically by calculating what the death rate or the mortality rate was before the war and then what the mortality rate was after the war began.
Okay.
And the difference between those two numbers is the mortality that's attributable to the war. Now, some of it may be by violence, like getting shot. Some of it may be natural causes, but that is dying of a heart attack, for example. But it's still attributable to the war because the hospitals had been devastated and doctors had been, sent abroad.
Inability
so
to
on.
Provide electricity could
yeah,
cause
the health, health infrastructure had been devastated. So the number that the Hopkins scientists came up with, working with health professionals in Iraq to do the survey in 2006, was 600,000 people had died to that point. A number that was shockingly high, although if you look at other wars of that kind, I'm not talking about World War II, but like the war in Bosnia or the war in Sri Lanka or the war in East Timor or other wars, it's not out of whack. It was about 5% of the population. Some of these other wars were much higher numbers as a percentage of the population. So, but it got a lot of blowback from the right wing, and I think that the war supporters, and I think that the reason for the criticism was an interesting one. In this society, you can make mistakes if you're the policymakers. If you make mistake about a war, a decision, you can be forgiven more or less if people think your motives were correct and the devastation of your own troops was not too great and so on. But killing civilians in large numbers is kind of unforgivable. Especially when you're denying that you're doing it. You know, Bush had said, oh, there are 30,000 civilians killed. It's regrettable, but that's about the right number. And then we're coming out and saying it's 20 times higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we didn't say they were all civilians. We just said Iraqis. But, you know, most of them, vast majority of them would have been civilians. Now, that number held up pretty well in view of subsequent household surveys is what they're called. Although it was a little high, but that's to be expected. You would probably look for, you know, to do several of those surveys, and then probably the average of those surveys is closer to what you actually get, because it's hard to do a randomized sample during a wartime.
You have refugees, you have houses that are abandoned, and
that's it's called a survivor bias, which is if a house is empty, the person taking the survey just goes on to the next house.
Right.
They don't, and that house is not counted at all. When in fact, if it's an empty house, that means either everybody's dead or somebody died and the rest of them left.
Right.
Or something like that. Most of the refugees that were interviewed in Syria and Jordan expressed their stories. They said that somebody in their family had been killed.
Right.
So you can bet that there was a survivor bias. But there it's a somewhat lengthy methodological discussion, which I won't get into right now, but the other major form of estimating comes through actually counting the names of people who were mentioned in news media accounts.
Right.
And that's what Iraq Body Count does, a London-based NGO.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a inferior way of accounting for the dead for lots of reasons I won't go into, but they had come up with something in the vicinity of, I think, about 150,000 eventually. So there were a lot of people who died no matter how you counted them, but I think it's the number is actually much closer to 600,000-700,000 at the end
of the day. Well, if there was a big a big battle like Fallujah, I don't imagine that the names of the people who were killed in that city were ever.
Well, exactly right. And of course, there were parts of the country that really weren't covered by the news media.
It's
very Baghdad centric, and the nature of the news media changed over those years. There was a lot of news coverage early on, and then it dwindled as reporters, American reporters, British reporters, came out of Iraq.
It was just too dangerous to be.
It was too dangerous. They couldn't, this at the same time, the newspaper industry was failing. And so you didn't have the same survey instrument, so to speak, as you had in 2003. So it's a very dodgy kind of methodology.
But what were the criticisms of your
And is it going to undercount regardless? Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that the right wing especially had some criticisms of your methodology of the 600,000. The count, the 600,000 from John Hopkins, what were their criticisms of that?
Well, they never could criticize the method because the method is a long-standing epidemiological method.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been much applied to mortality in wartime, but it's the same method that they measure disease prevalence, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So the method was pretty sound, and it was reviewed. It was peer reviewed, not only in the Lancet articles, but I want to say the Lancet. The Lancet is a British medical journal which published two of the household surveys. It was peer reviewed by others, and there was a lot of discussion about this, and still is a fair amount of discussion about it. In the end, I would say that the methods were not successfully attacked. But what became the point of attack was attacking the funders of the project. George Soros' foundation was one of the funders, not of the research actually, but of the public relations effort. And attacking Les Roberts, who was one of the researchers because he ran for Congress at one point on a Democratic ticket, that kind of stuff. It was ad hominem. And it was just vicious. And the thing is that I think it's quite interesting, though, that it was so vicious about, what was, in fact, a fairly good effort at being, having a scientific approach to this problem. When no one else was really, or very few were trying to measure the same thing. There were no efforts of this kind during Vietnam or Korea. All the survey type research in Vietnam was done many years after the war was over.
Right.
Same with Korea and Bosnia and other places. But I think it did hit a sore note or a sore point on the right and the war supporters, because civilian casualties are viewed as being morally reprehensible, even though people on the one hand feel indifferent about it to some extent, the public generally, still the media elite and opinion leaders are very sensitive to this topic, and so it's a kind of a schizophrenic approach to it, but nevertheless, I think that that's part of the reason why it became controversial.
Well, in one of your discussions of the AP investigations into Korea, you described how there was one apparent error in the investigative reporting that got blown up to try to discredit the whole thing. Like a person who couldn't have been at the place where the massacre happened or something like that.
Right. Well, there was a guy who was giving false testimony, basically. But he wasn't the only one who was...
Right.
Who they had on the record. They had many people on the record, and they had documents from the U.S. Army and so on. This is very typical. It happened with Haditha, too. I mean, Haditha, the right-wing attacked... people who were raising questions about Haditha, including the late Representative Murtha from Pennsylvania, who was always known as kind of the friend of the military, was himself a veteran, And he raised some really hard questions. I give him credit for it, partly because he was concerned about the mental health of the soldiers, thought they were overstressed. But the right wing went after him like nobody's business. I just couldn't believe it. It's a very interesting kind of little phenomenon when you see it happening.
Right, because he's straight. He'd been a staunch supporter of the U.S. military and war,
yeah.
And he'd had enough, I guess, at this point. And,
well, he was concerned about the troops.
Yeah.
He said, he said that.
That's an interesting point, because you make the point that the death of an American soldier is a big problem, and you know the advantage of an air war, like the new drone war that we have, is that American soldiers don't die, and that if civilians die, it's a long way from home. But there also seems to be a lot of indifference to the plight of American soldiers who return with PTSD, drug addictions, you know, suicidal, all of those kinds of things. Like, there just doesn't appear to me to be a lot of concern about that situation.
I agree. It's a disgrace, really, how veterans are treated. One of the things that has not been much discussed, and I have paid a lot of attention to this, not so much in the newspapers these days, but 2 or 3 years ago there was a lot of talk about PTSD and suicides, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely was it ever mentioned that the high rate of post-traumatic stress was maybe due to the kinds of operations these guys had to conduct.
Right.
And the treatment of civilians. Now, I don't know that for a fact. You know, I can't correlate incidents of PTSD to rules of engagement, so I would take a much deeper knowledge of the on-the-ground situation and so on. You'd have to do some interviews with these PTSD sufferers, but you know, it's kind of a logical thing to ask anyway, and the media simply was not asking it.
Well, yeah.
It was not mentioning it.
I've thought about that. I mean, PTSD sounds like a medical diagnosis, but I'm guessing, and again, I haven't talked to a lot of veterans, but I'm guessing that they saw things that traumatized them, like they saw a buddy getting blown up, or they saw a child being blown apart, or something.
Right.
You can easily imagine that things we know happened would have happened in front of soldiers, and it would have been traumatic. And then when they come back, you slap the label PTSD on it, and you can avoid talking about why they're traumatized.
Yes. And, of course, there were, you know, these things happened in previous wars, too, and it's not mm-hmm. clear that the incidence is much higher. It's in the reported incidence is higher. But it doesn't mean, you know, we used to call it shell shock in World War II. In World War I, they wouldn't even acknowledge that there was any psychological damage.
But even shell shock is a euphemism, right? Because it implies that the noise of the war, the
right.
big noises that causes it, but it, what might be more traumatic is seeing human beings killed in front of you. By
right.
weapons or by an out-of-control soldier or whatever it was, whether it's your fault or not, whether it's friend or enemy or civilian, it's still traumatic
mm-hmm.
to see that.
Yes.
And how much of a role do you think the education system in terms of, I guess, particularly politics and history, play in fostering these beliefs about the nobility of war and America's role in these wars?
Well, certainly the writing of history and the way history is taught in the schools. Now, of course, this has changed a great deal over the last 50 years or so, but when I was a school child, you know, there wasn't much questioning of the role of the United States in the world or in any of these wars or in continental expansion or anything of that sort. And, of course, we didn't much study things like Korea or the coups in Guatemala and Iran and things like that. And so we were, of course, led to believe that if the president decided to send troops somewhere, there was a damn good reason for it.
Right.
That has changed, I think, but it's changed more on the, you know, on the East Coast and the West Coast probably than in the great Midwest and the South and so on. People like Howard Zinn, who I studied with years ago, in writing The People's History of the United States, I think helped to alter these, you know, self-glorifying images of the United States as always doing right in the world. But what Richard Slotkin, a cultural historian, calls the frontier myth is still very strong in this country. And you could see it in the reporting around the time of the beginning of the Iraq War. Susan Faludi wrote a wonderful book called The Terror Dream, in which she uses Slotkin's analysis too, but she really details how reporters and commentators at the time of 9/11 and then 2003 invasion of Iraq had used metaphors about how we're gonna protect our women and we're gonna go take care of these savages overseas and that sort of thing. It was all out of the, you know, cowboys and Indians playbook. And this happens all the time.
So the frontier,
it's just remarkable. Pardon me?
The frontier is the civilization. We were going to civilize Iraq.
Yeah, the frontier the frontier myth comes from the Puritans, actually, in which they were going to build, you know, a city of God or a faithful community in this wilderness. And the wilderness was hostile, and it was hostile in part because of the savages that inhabited the wilderness, which is to say the indigenous peoples, and that we, the white settlers from Europe, would push out into the continent, into the wilderness, tame the wilderness, tame the savage, and reap the bounty of the wilderness. And that's basically the frontier myth. And they've been, you know, it's been going on now for close to 400 years. And as I mentioned earlier, when we reached the end of the continental frontier, people like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and others began to look abroad for the global frontier. And they were interested mainly in China, but the fact is that it took the United States to other places besides China, the Philippines being the first place. But then much later, after, you know, fighting two world wars, mainly to the Middle East, and that's where the frontier has been, that's where the bounty is, that's where the wilderness is, and that's where the savages are.
I was told by my previous guest that the original name for the Iraq War was Operation Iraqi Liberation, which spells oil, and that didn't play too well, but that's the bounty that a lot of people saw.
Yeah,
Iraq,
no, there's no question they didn't want to talk about it, but in fact, sometimes they would slip and talk about it, as James Baker did during the first Gulf War in Desert Storm. But, you know, there's no question that we were there because of the oil. And to tame the last resistor to American globalization, basically, in that region, which was Saddam Hussein, and then, of course, the possibility of also going after Iran. But it fits so neatly with the frontier myth in every way. And you could see in the language that people would use as the war was beginning how redolent those images remain, even to the point of Slotkin actually goes on at some length in this trilogy about the captivity myths. I won't go into the captivity stories.
There was this
great captivity story in Iraq with the woman who the soldier whose name I'm forgetting.
Yeah,
Frank Rich wrote a whole book about it, I think.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same. Taken by the savages. There was some implication of maybe sexual, intrigue. And then the Marines come in and free her and shoot up the place, you know. And, I mean, it's just exactly what these frontier stories were like.
I would love to talk more about this, but I'm getting signals that we've reached the end of our hour. But it's been an illuminating conversation, and I hope that people will take the time to read your book, The Deaths of Others, and other books that you've written, because I think they're very challenging and very interesting and very important.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.